What is up, everyone? Welcome back to episode number 8 of the Bronx Beat here on Fireside Yankees. My name is Ryan Garcia, joined as always by Gary Phillips, beat writer for the New York Daily News covering the New York Yankees. He has returned from Tampa. He is back in cold weather, just like most of us listening, or myself in this situation as well. Gary, how you doing today, man?
Yeah, still getting over that cold that was spreading around the beat down in spring training. But as you said, I am back in New York. I am back in the comfort of my own home. Little cold. Didn't love the change in weather when I got off the plane, but such is. I'll be back down in Florida next week, actually, for a bachelor party in Orlando, and then back to spring training at the end of camp. So I got some more weather, good weather in my future.
Well, I think you're going to enjoy getting away the week you are getting away, because I believe you're going to be missing a snowstorm. So you keep missing them, man. Like, I'm going to have to do a lot of shoveling again this week, which I'm not looking forward to, but it is what it is. But Gary, the Yankees actually did another move while you were still in Tampa, I believe, or maybe it was the night that you were coming back. But Randall Grichuk signed with the New York Yankees on a minor league deal. This deal is reported to also have, I believe, a $2.5 million incentive if he makes the major league roster. It comes with a non-roster invite. He does not have a guaranteed spot on the roster just yet. But Gary, it looks like this is the right-handed hitting outfielder that they've been looking for. What are your thoughts on this signing and why they made this move?
Yeah, so they finally found that right-handed bat in the outfield that they've been looking for all offseason. You know, they've kind of explored this market for the last several months. They had shown varied levels of interest in players like Austin Slater, Austin Hayes, Harrison Bader. You know, those last two guys signed for salaries and roles that were more than what the what made sense for the Yankees. But, you know, this was an area they were looking to address. They were looking to bring in at least an option who could fill that role. So that is Randall Grichuk. You know, like you said, he's going to get $2.5 million if he makes the team. That is not guaranteed. It's also not guaranteed that, you know, he's ready for the start of the season, right? Like, he's playing catch up, coming into camp a little bit late here, but nice little salary if he makes the team. I was told there are some performance bonuses included in there as well. And basically what he would be if he is on the roster is a bench piece. He would be the fourth outfielder. He's capable of playing all three spots. You know, he would most likely see action in left field with Cody Bellinger slotting to center field and Trent Grisham coming out of the lineup against the lefty. Grichuk has had some really impressive numbers against left-handed pitchers in the past. You know, not so much this past season. He only had a 703 OPS against them, but that number was 913 in 2024 and 995 in 2023. So he's got a good track record of hitting southpaws. He's got actually a great track record of killing the Yankees. So if nothing else, you know, the Bombers don't have to run into him anymore for a little while. But yeah, I would expect him to have a real shot at making this team. Maybe not necessarily right at the start of the season, but he could be a guy that factors into the bench plans.
Yeah, and as you noted with Randall Grichuk, somebody who does kill the Yankees, he has 18 home runs against the Yankees in a grand total of 255 plate appearances. That is an MVP level pace in terms of home run damage. But what I found interesting is he actually tags the Orioles way worse, 22 home runs in 251 plate appearances and a 1.055 OPS. So there are two American League East teams that he owns. One of them probably not as happy to know that he's in the division, but definitely not the player he was maybe a few years ago, just given with age and the performance he had last year. But he's signing to a deal that suggests, hey, this is a guy who could hit lefties, but if it doesn't work out, they don't have a commitment to him on the roster. But Gary, in regard to his role on this team and the fact that he could make this team out of camp, what does this mean for Oswaldo Cabrera and Jason Dominguez, who their roles suddenly become a little bit more muddied?
Yeah, I think this increases the likelihood that both of those players start the season at AAA. I think those possibilities were already pretty high to begin with. If you've been paying attention to what the Yankees have been saying about those two players, you know, starting with Dominguez, you know, we had Brian Cashman a couple weeks ago basically say, like, he needs everyday reps and those are in his best interest. Well, we know that those don't exist at the major league level unless Aaron Judge, Trent Grisham, or Cody Bellinger, or Giancarlo Stanton get hurt, right? So Yeah, he was probably already going to start the season at AAA. You know, at best, he would have been the fourth outfielder, but you know, he's weaker from the right side of the plate. He only plays left field. He doesn't play it particularly well, so he's not exactly an ideal fourth outfielder, whereas Grichuk, you know, checks off that right-handed box, and he plays all three outfield positions. So that's certainly something Grichuk has going in his favor that Dominguez did not. And then with Cabrera, the Yankees have been very non-committal to him starting the season on time. He's coming back from a gruesome ankle fracture, you know, last season. That was in May. I know he expected to be a full go coming into camp, but the Yankees have said we're going to kind of slow play things. Aaron Boone the other day said that, you know, next week, you know, toward the end of next week could be when he makes his spring debut. So that probably puts him behind. You know, Boone said that Cabrera's ankle's looking better and better. He's moving better and better, but still kind of looking for that last level of burst. So on paper, Oswaldo, you know, pencils in perfectly as that backup shortstop, a guy that can play the corner outfield if needed in a pinch, can play a whole bunch of other positions, but it doesn't look like he is going to be ready, or at least it doesn't look like the Yankees are going to be pushing him for that opening day timeline. So, once again, guy who has an option probably starts the year at AAA, especially now that Grichuk is in the fold.
Yeah, and I also think it's important to note that we haven't even reached March yet, so injuries can still pop up and create openings for these guys. And it's good for this team to have depth because every single year there's a guy who's going to go down. Obviously, Giancarlo Stanton's kind of like the poster child of that given his recent injury history, but guys you don't expect will miss time. I don't think I expected to find out that Aaron Judge had a UCL problem last year or an elbow problem last year, and then he did. I don't know if I expected Josh Chisholm's lower body to give out in April for a month, and it did. And that's where you're going to need some depth. That's where guys like Cabrera and Dominguez could get a good chunk of playing time. And in previous years, especially in the first half of last year, it did not feel like they had more than nine guys capable of playing major league games for them. And I do think that hurt them a little bit at times. Do you have any final thoughts on the depth chart overall on this bench?
Yeah, I actually did a piece on the depth chart this morning as far as the bench goes. And the way I look at it is right now, barring injuries, there are two reserve seats on the bench. And those go to Paul Goldschmidt and Amed Rosario. Goldschmidt, you know, those are both right-handed hitters. Goldschmidt, we know, can only play first base. Rosario, we know, is going to get some time at third base. He can also play some other positions not particularly well. The Yankees do not view him as a viable backup at shortstop, even though he played there earlier in his career. So if they're using him there at any point, it's an emergency situation. The way the bench shakes out, like maybe right now Rosario is that emergency backup shortstop because I'm not sure what they do with the last two pieces on the bench, right? Like it could be Grichuk only plays the outfield. And then are you keeping JC Ascara or are you putting Ben Rice in more of a traditional backup role? That might depend whether the Yankees can roster a legitimate backup shortstop like Cabrera, like Max Schumann, like Paul DeJong. You know, so those are kind of the decisions they're going to have to look at. The way Boone has talked about JC Ascara, it sounds like he views him as his backup catcher. It sounds like he wants to have, you know, that true traditional backup catcher role filled, opposed to, you know, Ben Rice just plays there when he's not playing first base. I think if you put Rice in that true backup role, you know, maybe things get a little risky or dangerous as far as workload, possibility of an injury if you have Rice and Austin Wells in the game at the same time. So the Yankees are going to have to decide what exactly they want to do with Ascara, and then that's going to determine the, I guess, viability or dependability of their backup infielder, which particularly at that shortstop position, right? Do you lean on somebody like Rosario there who really can't play the position anymore, or do you carry somebody like Schumann or DeJong or even Oswaldo if he's ready over a guy like Ascara? That's what it's going to come down to. If I were betting right now, I would say Goldschmidt, Rosario, Ascara are on that bench, and then probably Grichuk if he has a good spring, but still some time to go.
Yeah, I think, again, it'll be interesting to see how this thing plays out. I'm just happy that they have depth. I'm happy that there are options when guys go down because, again, like at times last year, Yorbit Vivas is coming up, and Yorbit Vivas did not perform well at the big league level. and that was alongside having Pablo Reyes and Oswald Peraza in the infield mix. That was on top of having to bring back LeMahieu and play him for a good chunk of the early parts of the summer because he was your best fourth infielder, arguably, and then his body couldn't really hold up at second. And like, I don't want to deal with that again. I want capable big leaguers who can play their positions at the very least or provide some offensive upside. Not like Cabrera's a world beater, not like Schumann or DeJong are world beaters, but I do think they can play their positions. And more so with Cabrera, I think he can provide a competitive at bat in certain situations. So I am excited that they have about 28, 29 guys who are going to be hopefully healthy around the opening day mark, or at least a week after, that can play big league innings, and you're not having a complete black hole in your roster with that situation. But let's move on to the pitching side of things here, because Ryan Weathers made a lot of headlines in his spring training debut. He struck out five batters. He set a new career high in pitch velocity at 99.8 miles per hour. Gary, what are some things he's been doing in the offseason that might have helped him have a pretty strong first impression?
The other day, I wrote a story about how Weathers kind of revamped his offseason training routine. It's something he's been kind of messing with and searching for a couple of years now. But this past offseason, he went to a place called Peak Kinetic Performance in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was co-founded by Mariners pitcher Cole Wilcox. The two of them were in the Padres system together earlier in their careers. And basically what Weathers did, and this is before he even got traded to the Yankees, was he underwent this assessment on his body that looked at his shoulders, his ankles, his joints, his muscles, lats, this and that. And what it found was that, you know, certain exercises, particularly in the weight room that he had been doing in the past, were creating this unnecessary stress on his forearm and his lat, you know, two areas where he got hurt last season with the Marlins. So what he kind of did was cut out a bunch of lifting patterns from his routine. He replaced them with, you know, foam roller exercises, body rolling exercises. He said, you know, like he likes to just pull in his knees and kind of rock back and forth on the ground, you know, almost like, you know, fetal position. But he's saying like that helps his spine out. He said that he likes to dangle from pull-up bars and kind of just hang there, and that helps him stretch his lat out. So he's hoping these things really help him stay healthy this season. That's something he's obviously struggled with in the past. Now, he is still doing some lifting. It's not like he's just not going to the weight room anymore, but he and the Yankees, you know, after he got traded, kind of talked about his new routine, what he wanted out of it, and Yankees training staff was basically on the same page with him. Like, yeah, this is good. This makes sense. Let's keep doing this. And Weathers said, basically going back to the offseason, ever since he's started playing catch, you know, he's felt great. Recovery has felt great the next day. He said one of his first live batting practice sessions in spring training, you know, I talked to him the day after that, and he was like, yeah, I feel loose. I feel fine. Like, I didn't even throw two innings the previous day. So, obviously, it's very early in the year. The baseball season is a marathon, a grueling one at that. But Weathers sounds confident that he has a routine that's going to keep him on the field a little more, and that's huge because we saw the other night like how nasty his stuff can be.
Yeah, I don't think the question with Weathers' ability. I really don't. And I also do think for organizations such as the Yankees, teams trying to win a World Series, you're seeing them on the pitching side take more risks on availability versus ability. I continue to kind of point to the Jesus Luzardo trade with the Phillies where they trade for him. I know he had already broken out to an extent, but they got him when he was damaged goods, when his health was in serious question, when I think there was even a deal with the Cubs that could have been had if it wasn't for poor medicals. When he originally arrived in Miami, he was an oft-injured, talented lefty. I think that there is that world where Ryan Weathers, with the changes he's made to his mix, with the velocity he has, that he can break out and be an impact starter, maybe even in the top half of this rotation. But of course, that comes down to availability. And I wonder how many innings he can produce this year. I wonder if the Yankees will manage that at all during the season. I think that all comes down to, A, how effective he is, B, how many starters they do have healthy at the same time, things of that nature. But I really liked what I saw in terms of some changes he made. He was throwing his sinker and his gyro slider notably more. Gary, what stood out to you the most about his first outing and what you saw, whether it was from the stat sheet or the video itself?
I mean, the velocity's huge, right? But I was also impressed with the movement on the fastball and really the movement across his entire arsenal. Like, he had five pitches the other day that graded out over 100 as far as stuff plus goes. That's a really deep arsenal, and you know, some room for improvement within those five pitches as well. I know the Yankees want to refine how he uses his breaking balls. I know they want him throwing that sinker against lefties a little bit more this year, but like, I saw five pitches that are capable of getting a guy out. That's huge. And you know, you mentioned his age, like, he's still only 26 years old, so there's not only is there still a ton of potential, not only is he not a, you know, written book after all these injuries and some disappointing years or, you know, missing a breakout season, like, he's still growing and maturing and learning as a pitcher. He's learning how to use a five-pitch mix. He's doing it now in a different organization that's well-regarded for their pitching development. I'm really curious to see where Weathers and the Yankees can take that arsenal, you know, as he continues to mature on the mound.
Yeah, again, I think that with Ryan Weathers, it's not a question of his ability, it's a question of availability. He'll be a big part of this rotation because he's going to be in the opening day rotation, barring an injury. I'm a big believer in stuff. I think his stuff is excellent, and I ultimately think that there's a lot of upside here, and I'm excited to see what that ends up looking like. We're going to take a step back here, and we're going to broaden our view a little bit on the spring training situation because, Gary, I kind of wanted to ask you about, from your first couple of weeks at spring training, which stories did you find to be the most fascinating so far and the ones that you were the most, I don't know if the word's curious or the most, the ones that you learned the most from so far?
Well, definitely the sewage situation at Steinbrenner Field, right? Like, that was by far the most interesting and funny story of the, you know, first 2 weeks of camp. No, I'm kidding. Well, I did have a good time with that and, you know, certainly got my laughs off. I thought the most interesting thing was Carlos Agrané, honestly. Just, you know, lots of attention was paid to him and what he was doing. You know, there were a couple instances where it was clearly like, okay, the Yankees are testing this kid, right? You had that live batting practice session against Aaron Judge and the other big boys in the lineup. I thought it was noticeable how many members of the Yankees front office, including Brian Cashman, were out there paying very close attention to what Legrandhe was doing. I really liked learning about him off the field. Obviously, the stuff is huge. The fastball is triple digits, but I kept hearing over and over again that his intangibles are really incredible. His leadership at just 22 years old is, you know, something that the Yankees have taken note of. Preston Claiborne, the Yankees assistant pitching coach, who was previously one of their minor league pitching coaches, was telling me a bunch of stories about how Legrandhe took initiative after a walk-heavy 2024 and, you know, took it upon himself to get with coaches and get down to the Yankees complex and, you know, traveled on his own dime and basically said, like, I want to fix my mechanics. Like, let's go. Let's not wait for this. There was also some talk about how last year he got, you know, stolen on a bunch of times in one game. And the next day he came in and said, like, we're learning a slide step, like, now, ASAP. So there were just a lot of stories like that. A lot of attention was paid to Legrandhe. And I thought it was just really notable how much his stuff was his not. I thought it was really notable that the Yankees talked about his intangibles as much as they talked about his stuff. Like, we knew the talent, we knew the pedigree as a top prospect. I'm not sure everybody realized, like, the makeup component is there as well for him.
And I think Legrandhe is going to just naturally be one of the bigger stories of spring training as somebody who has kind of the eye popping stuff. And as you mentioned, I think it's awesome that there is that story off the field of who he is, how he works. I think those things have to kind of go hand in hand, especially one thing that stood out to me is when Judge was talking about his demeanor on the mound, where you need that, like he talked about, you need to have that kind of demeanor to pitch in the Bronx. There is pressure. Like, there's always going to be pressure being a New York Yankee. There's a lack of, like, there's going to be a lot of pressure when he does arrive to the big leagues. There'll be a lot of attention on him, both good and bad. That just kind of comes with, it comes with being a Yankee. So I do think that was really good. That was a really fun thing to hear about. I did want to ask you about one story in particular when it came to having conversations with Ryan McMahon, did you get the sense that he's a little more comfortable here now? Like, given that he's had a whole offseason going from Colorado to, boom, you're now in New York?
I'm not sure comfort was ever really an issue for him. Like, he seemed happy and excited and to fit in right away when he got traded last year. For those that don't know, like, Ryan McMahon is a super easygoing, super nice, super comfortable guy. I mean, he's been good with the reporters and media from day one, never seemed timid or shy or unwilling to talk or thrown off by the large media contingent that he obviously wasn't used to with the Rockies. So I'm not sure he was ever uncomfortable. He certainly looks more comfortable at the plate now that he's changed his stance.
I'm curious to see how he is this year, because I think that with that contract, he does have a guarantee for next year that he's going to get paid next year. Not a guarantee he's on the team, because that can't be a guarantee, but I do find his season to be far more interesting than maybe people give it credit for, just because of how the third base position has been for the last few years, where there has been a lot of turnover at the position. They've had to move Jazz there numerous times, and I think they don't want to keep doing that. And there is at least some level of like, ooh, when is George LeBar Jr. coming up? Don't think it'll be this year, but I do think that third base is going to be interesting to follow this year. Is there any players that you walked away from this spring training going, I got to pay a much closer attention or a closer eye to this guy after seeing him in the Grapefruit League?
He's definitely McMahon. He's definitely a guy that I'm going to be paying closer attention to. Like, he's gotten off to a pretty good start at the plate. I'm curious if he can continue that through the spring. I'm curious, you know, how he'll look in the first month or two of the season at the plate. He's obviously an elite defender at third base. If he could be a league average hitter, like, we're not talking sky high expectations or, you know, asking him to be a world beater at the plate, right? But like, if he could be a league average hitter compared with his defense, you know, that's an immensely valuable player. I'm not sure fans realize, like, okay, 100 WRC plus from Ryan McMahon plus top shelf defense at third base, that would be huge for the Yankees. It would be a huge upgrade over what they got from the position overall last season. That's with Oswaldo Cabrera, Oswald Peraza, Pablo Reyes, a little bit of Jazz thrown in a third. Like, it was not a good position for the Yankees last year on both sides of the ball. So I think McMahon can be a stabilizing force. Rosario will play there sometimes when the Yankees are facing lefties, but that's going to be McMahon's position, and he's a guy I think that fans should keep on their radar. As far as other players that I'm thinking about and going to be paying closer attention to this spring, I think a lot of it comes down to the bullpen, right? Like, that's where the majority of the intrigue is on this roster. So we're talking about guys like Jake Bird, Cade Winquest, Brent Hedrick, all these guys kind of fighting for a bullpen spot that we've talked about on the show already a lot. Like, those are the arms that I'm going to be keeping an eye on from afar, and then certainly when I get back down there for the end of spring training.
Yeah, and I do think the bullpen's just, it has to be a point of intrigue, or at least of curiosity, given the lack of certainty as to what certain guys' roles will look like, who's actually going to be in the bullpen, and which guys are or are not going to break out. I do think, Gary, this might be a good point to pivot to our mailbag, because one of our questions pertains to the bullpen, if you're ready to go there.
Yeah, I see it. We got a bullpen question from Robert Matei.
Yeah, Matei. Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. If we butchered it, please just comment and let us know the pronunciation. I will adjust that for next time. But he asks, out of all the low risk, high reward relievers we picked up, Bird, Winquest, Javici are some of the names he used as examples, who are you the most excited for with the changes, and who do you think has the highest ceiling in 2026? Gary, I think it's kind of a two-parter, so I guess which guys had the changes that have caught your eye the most, and who has the highest ceiling?
I'm going to look at this through the lens of, I guess, where I see these guys in the bullpen race. I think we talked on the last show that, you know, all things considered equal, I would give Cade Winquest and Jake Bird the edge. So I'm going to go with those guys. With Bird, I wrote recently about how he's tweaked his cutter, and as well as his sinker, it seems like that's really working out for him so far this spring. That gives him several pitches that he could get a pretty high whiff rate on if all's going well with him. I like his mechanics. I think they're funky. I think they're deceptive. I think there's something to having an array of looks and deception in your bullpen, right? Like, you don't want everybody throwing from the same arm slot. There was that graphic a couple years ago where it had every Rays reliever and it, you know, each of their arm slots made a circle like a clock. Like, there's something to that, seeing a different look as an opposing hitter with each team's reliever. So I think there's a lot to like about Bird. Obviously, he's got to put it all together. Obviously, it was not a good first impression that he made last year, but I also think he was overworked by the Rockies and overused. Now he's coming to a place where he's rested, his pitches are a little more refined, he's certainly got some more data, analytics, insight from the coaching staff behind him, right? Like, the Rockies were operating in the Stone Age under their previous regime. So he's a guy that I'm going to keep an eye on. And then Winquest is somebody that the Yankees have really been impressed with. Now, he's got the Rule 5 draft pick attached to him, so it's kind of take it or leave him, right? Like, he has to make the roster or the Yankees risk losing him and giving him back to the Cardinals even. So I think he's going to get, every step of the way, he's going to get a chance to make the team so long as he's healthy and pitching well. But they've also been impressed with what they've seen so far. And that includes a new sinker that he worked on over the offseason with Matt Blake.
Yeah, and on the note of this sinker, the shape of this pitch is something I really like. It's got 7.7 inches of induced vertical break, 14.3 inches of horizontal break, so there's a good amount of depth and run. He gets good extension on everything he throws. The velocity isn't where it was just yet in the minor league, so I do wonder if there's a little more buildup there, but if there is any more velocity for him to add as we get through the February and March months, then I think he could be a plus reliever in the big leagues. I just tend to like relievers with deep mixes, and he's got four-seamer, curveball, sinker, changeup, or I think it's a splitter, actually, and a sweeper. So there's a good amount of mix there. I'm curious to see how he looks throughout the rest of spring training. I do want to mention Brett Hedrick in this as well, just because I've always been impressed with him, and that's just kind of my guy. And in terms of, like, I think he can be a real plus reliever in this league. Obviously, there is a little bit of roster, like, flexibility you have to take into account here. Would you rather have Winquest, Bird, and Hedrick all in the organization with Hedrick in AAA, or have just one of Winquest or Bird? Because I think you could option Bird, but, like, I don't think they're going to do that. Would you rather have just Hedrick and Bird and Winquest out of the organization? I think that's something the Yankees are going to seriously consider, especially given how injury-prone the team could be. If Yarbrough has to go into the rotation, that's a bullpen spot that opens up. Suddenly you can roster Hedrick again. I think that's going to have to play a role in what they do with this bullpen decision. But is there any final notes you have there?
If Yarbrough goes into the rotation, it's not just a bullpen spot that opens up. It's a left-handed bullpen spot that opens up for Brent Hedrick. So something to keep an eye on. I think if the rotation stays healthy and Yarbrough's in the bullpen, maybe that works against Hedrick. But whenever we ask Boone about, under-the-radar bullpen guys or, the guys that are part of the competition for the open spots, Hedrick's always the first guy that he mentions. Boone's a really big fan of Hedrick. He really likes his stuff. He thinks that now that he's kind of focused strictly on a reliever's routine, he wasn't last year, now that the velocity is going to play up. So he's got a huge fan in the manager. The roster logistics, the left-handedness might work against him as far as just who makes the opening day roster.
And to the note of what I said with the position players, I think it's a good thing that they might have a ninth reliever who has upside, has intrigue, and can be the first man up if somebody goes down. I think with the state of this bullpen, you need to have more than eight guys that you can at least think of as big leaguers or have a realistic expectation that they can contribute a little bit for your team this upcoming season. Depth's important. Guys get hurt all the time. That's a big part of this conversation. Any final thoughts on the bullpen before we move on to our next question?
No, I think that covers it.
Well, I'd like to thank Robert again for submitting the question, and we'll move on to a question from Max So Frankful, and he asks, do you see the Yankees making any more moves? Gary, we were asked a similar question last time we did this. The Yankees have since signed Randall Grichuk. Do you think they're pencils down, or do you think they're still keeping an eye to the market?
Brian Cashman will tell you it's never pencils down until the trade deadline, right? With that said, I think as far as significant moves, I would suspect that they are done at this point. You always see, you know, waiver wire pickups, guys who get cut, you know, switch camps during spring training, switch teams, you know, maybe at the end of spring training when rosters cuts start happening, the Yankees make some minor claims, some minor trades, things of that nature. But I think right now, like, the larger pieces are in place.
Especially since if it was an addition, it would have to be on the pitching side. And there is a new variable here now, which is, and you hinted at this with Randall Grichuk, these guys are going to have to get ready in while spring training is going on. So let's say a team signs a Danny Collin. This is not just specific to the Yankees, just a team in general. He's going to have to get built up into game action and ready for opening day on an accelerated timeline. That's definitely going to affect, I think, how teams look at the current bullpen market, where you're picking up a guy who has a good chance of not being ready for opening day, even if he's fully healthy. Gary, do you think that plays a role in any of the Yankees' decision-making?
I think it plays a role in what could the opening day roster look like, right? Like, if the Yankees find a deal that's to their liking and potentially addresses a need down the road, I don't think they'll pass on a guy just because he won't be ready until April 15th or whatever it is, right? But as far as the likeliest candidates to make the opening day roster, like, I think at this point, if they're not in camp, that they're not going to be in play for March 25th.
Yeah, again, we've got less than a month now. We're past the month threshold, so I do think that's going to play a role in who can or cannot be ready for opening day if the Yankees were to add some cheap reliever in the next couple of weeks. Any final thoughts on the bullpen? Any additional moves they can make before we move on?
No.
Well, I want to thank Max So Frankful for the question. That was on Twitter. Let's move to another kind of pitching adjacent question here, and that's from PVZH Grookey, I think is how you pronounce it. They ask, let's say Weathers looks really good, Heel looks good, Warren looks good, who's the odd man out? Because we know Fried, Rodon, and Cole are staples. Gary, is there any inclination that there is a way the Yankees would lean when guys come back?
I think it's way too early to start getting into all that, right? Like, we don't know when exactly Cole or Rodon is going to be back. There could always be setbacks with guys on the injured list. Somebody else could always get hurt, right? Like, Max Fried, Cam Schlittler, Will Warren, they're all coming off of career-high workloads. Weathers and Heel have, you know, pretty notable injury histories. Like, we don't know what's going to happen in a month, 2 months, 3 months. One thing I will say is that this question has been posed to Boone a couple times with the expectation, this coming from the person asking the question, that it would be Will Warren that slots into the bullpen just automatically. Not sure why he's always been the one, you know, pegged as the guy who's got to go in this scenario, but Boone has repeatedly said, like, Will Warren is a starter. We view him as a starter. Does that mean he can't slot into the bullpen if a need arises or things get a little too crowded? No, like, maybe that does still happen, but the way Boone has talked about him is the Yankees see him as a starting pitcher for the short term and the long term.
And again, it's the asterisk of, hey, you're going to have six guys healthy at the same time. I'll see it when I believe it. That's always my mentality with pitchers. I'll see it when I believe it, that a team has six guys healthy for an extended period of time in their rotation, six guys that they plan on having there.
It's a cliche that, you know, managers and baseball executives and people in the industry will say, like, all these things have a way of sorting themselves out. But, like, it's true. Like, I can't remember too many instances, you know, since I've been on the beat where, you know, I started thinking ahead of, like, okay, who's going to move where if so-and-so comes back and everybody's healthy? And almost every single time, by the time that the guy on the injured list comes back, somebody else has moved to the injured list as well. Like, it really does just happen that way, it seems like. So I'm curious to see if that stays true this year, because, yeah, the Yankees certainly have more than five starters.
The key points I remember where I was like, okay, at this time it's going to finally happen, was end of 24, They had Stroman as the sixth starter for a little bit, and then Nestor had an elbow issue, and that forced Stroman back into the rotation for the final week of the year. At the start of 25, I was like, okay, Warren's going to get demoted for Schmidt, and then Stroman had a knee issue, which forced Schmidt back into the rotation. Then the question was, what would Stroman's role be when he comes back from injury? Then Yarbrough got hurt, which opened up a role for Stroman. It just this is how it goes. It's just how it goes. Guys, someone is almost always going to be hurt by the time another guy comes back. And there is just too much time between now and I think Cole is expected to be back in like late May, early June, somewhere in that range. Like there are
that would be the early side. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a lot of time for somebody to have a issue. And I also think it would make maybe a pitcher a little less like I've got to go out the 5th day if I'm dealing with something. I'm sure if you have five starters, if Cole comes back and you actually do have guys healthy, but a guy's banged up a little, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to give that guy time off and let him nurse that injury.
Yeah, and you know, keep in mind, spring training and the early parts of the season are the likeliest time for pitchers to get hurt. And so far, the Yankees have been relatively healthy in camp. I'm still kind of waiting for that shoe to drop just because there is a little bit of like an inevitable element to pitcher injuries this time of year, right? Like I know Schlittler had the minor back lat issue and you know Boone said the other day that he's expecting him to be ready for the start of the season. But beyond that, the Yankees haven't really had any pitching injuries thus far. The chances of them getting through the next month or so without that happening are pretty slim just based on the way baseball history has gone.
Yeah, I will point to the fact that at this point last year, Gerrit Cole and Luis Seal were both healthy. That is where we're Cole made two spring starts before getting hurt, I believe. He made two. He made one against the Blue Jays, one against the Twins. So there's still time. We have to still wait these things out. I'm sure the Yankees are hoping and crossing their fingers that nothing pops up. I think the one time they went through spring training without a major rotation injury was 2022, where Severino, Cortez, Cole, Tyone, and Montgomery all made it through, but that is one in the last, 5 years, 6 years at this point. So that's an outlier, not a theme. So Gary, any final notes you have on the rotation and that depth chart at this point?
You never have enough pitching, right?
It is an adage as old as baseball, and it is never going to not be true. I feel like it's actually become more true. As baseball has gone on and as we've gotten into the StatCast era and pitching analytics have continued to take off. So, going to need as many guys as you possibly can have. And a final question. This is not a baseball question, but I think it is an important question. Gary, this is from Cruise Control Era on Twitter, and he asks, what is a good way to get into sports writing? How can someone new start out?
Wow, that's a big question. I think the answer has probably changed since I've been in college and getting started in the industry, right? Like there's so many more avenues now to start, especially if you don't have like a college education or you didn't go to school for journalism, I should say. Like, hey, look at Fireside Yankees, right? Like that's an avenue that somebody could just start writing or start making a name for themselves, a brand for themselves. I would say for me, like what worked for me when I was in college was I was really focused on reporting about my school, Seton Hall, you know, the community there. I wasn't trying to necessarily write about the Yankees or the Knicks or the Jets or the Giants as a freshman in, you know, or sophomore in college because, yeah, maybe I knew the rosters and I knew the stats and I watched the games, but I didn't have access. I didn't have sources. I didn't have anything that would make my coverage stand out from, you know, the Daily News or the New York Post or the Athletic or whatever it was at the time, right? Like I was really focused on reporting within my community, building, you know, a nice portfolio of clips and stories and articles that were really well reported and showed that I could do the reporting and the interviewing and the sourcing. And, you know, the idea was, okay, when I graduate, somebody's going to see that. They're going to hopefully assume or believe that I can apply that now to a larger beat, a larger team, a larger community, whatever it may be. And, you know, hey, yeah, we'll hire you because you know how to do the reporting side of it. You know, you can learn the, I guess, the baseball side of it or the roster side of it, right? Like that comes with just watching the team, being around a team, paying attention. Now, I'm not totally sure. Like, you know, there are definitely ways to write about a team and write about sports without necessarily being on the ground, in the clubhouse, with access. Like, there's a huge appetite for stats-based coverage or, you know, analysis, things like that. There's, you don't even have to necessarily do writing, right? Like, you could do podcasts, you could do videos, things like that. So I'm not sure what the best answer to that question is in 2026. I know that for me, circa 2016, 2017, like for me, the best way to get into it was really focusing on the teams and the communities that I had access to.
And I do think it's important to still, like, I don't think that should ever change about media. I'm a staunch believer you need good people who can provide good reporting. But as you did note, like, there is, I think it has changed in a sense that there is just more ways to kind of get up and going and try to write or try to provide analysis about a team. The way I started was I saw the ESM website on, like, a Dellin Betances to the Mets article, I think it was. And I was just scrolling on my laptop. I really wanted to get into media. I knew I was bad at baseball. And yeah, that's kind of what happened. And I just kept writing and writing, and it just kind of worked out in a positive way. But I don't know if my story is necessarily a necessarily like repeatable one. I kind of lucked out a little bit. But yeah,
I would also add, you don't need a credential or a giant media company behind you to get started. Like, you can start a blog. You can reach out to people over social media if you want to talk to them and do stories on them. You can send emails, DMs, like whatever it is, trying to get an interview or trying to get access to a certain event. You know, maybe the Yankees aren't going to credential you for games, but maybe Jazz Chisholm Jr. and his camp credential you for a clinic that he's doing, you know, in the area, and you go and do something like that. You know, like, I remember I used to be at FanRag Sports, which it no longer exists, and I couldn't get credentials from the Yankees at the time. I was still a junior or senior in college, and, you know, what I would do is I would figure out players who were having clinics in the local area, and I would go to those and try to get interviews with them there, and you know, start trying to form relationships and get interviews done, things like that. You know, basically on my own time, you know, getting up early in the morning to go drive somewhere in the middle of New Jersey or New York City or wherever it was, just hoping I could get like 5 minutes with, I remember doing a Didi Gregorius clinic, right? And like that was one of my first big league interviews. The Yankees didn't credential that. A giant media company didn't assign me to go do that. Like, it took a little bit of initiative and, you know, just asking. Sometimes you just got to ask.
You never know what'll come out from an opportunity. And I do think one note that I did not emphasize enough from your previous statements were about, like, getting involved in the school side. Like, I think it is important to be part of your school's media apparatus, whether it's like for myself, like I'm at the radio station for our college, we have a newspaper, things of that nature. Like, whatever you can get involved with, get involved. Even if your college isn't like known for their journalism program, get involved. Like, you never know what experience you'll learn, what you'll pick up, who you'll meet, and what opportunities come out of it. And it's a good way to get experience in an area where you can not say like you're intentionally trying to screw up, but there's a little bit more margin for error in like the high school level, or depending on which college you are and what role you're in. Like, it's not like you're going to lose your job, if that makes sense, right? Like, there's a little, like, it's not like in high school you get fired from a school paper because you put a typo in there, you know? So it's a good place to learn how to make mistakes and to kind of learn how to, what is or is not good for media and good for what you're trying to do. So yeah, Gary, any final notes on that?
No. I think that pretty much covers it.
Yeah, and I will also say, like, on the note of screwing up, I mean, I can count on my I don't think I can count on my hands the amount of mistakes I've made in the last 3 days. Like, whether it's a typo in a tweet or not putting a certain clip that I wanted to put in at a certain time, like, it happens. I'm very fortunate that I can make mistakes, and sometimes the audience doesn't notice, but that, and be confident. Like, I'm about as confident in my own abilities as I can be. I'm not saying you want to be cocky, but, you know, confidence, right? You don't want to not believe in yourself to do something that you're trying to do, if that makes sense. And that's very corny cliche, but I do think self-belief is like a big part of this, because it's a very much like self-initiated, as you mentioned, with like putting yourself out there and being okay getting a no. Like, someone's going to watch this and try and apply for a credentialed event, and they're going to get a no, and that's going to be fine. Like, you'll live. It's the worst answer you'll get, you know, if you ask the right way, of course, unless you say something completely vulgar. I guess that could be worse.
I'm still getting no's. I'm still getting rejected for interviews and stories that I want to do. I'm still making mistakes and screwing up all the time. Just, you know, you always got to just strive to be better, right?
Yeah, and again, just... I'm a big, like, hey, believe in yourself. If I believe in myself in anything, it's media, or like understand, or like knowing that I can edit a video. I know what a good pitch looks like, and what a bad pitch looks like. Those kinds of things. So yeah, that's all I really have. That's all we really have. I think it's not the most eventful time of year in terms of transactions. The Randall Grichuk signing is probably one of the bigger news we'll get in the next coming weeks regarding roster additions. So if you enjoy this kind of content, make sure you like, subscribe, and turn on that notification bell. If you're listening to this on Apple or Spotify, you can leave a 5-star rating and download the podcast to support the podcast itself. Furthermore, you can check out all the articles that Gary mentioned in this video in the link in the description. You might be noticing headlines. Those headlines have links in the description. Those are from the New York Daily News and Gary's coverage of the team. You can also check out our social media pages at Fireside Yankees on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, and of course, its YouTube page. Our Twitter accounts are on the overlay, but for those who are listening on audio, it's at Gary H. Phillips for Gary, and for myself, at Ryan Garcia ESM. As always, thank you so much for tuning into the Bronx Beat. And until next time, we'll see you guys. Peace out.